discontent throughout the country. Mobs of a menacing character assembled in different parts of London. Fears of riots were generally entertained, especially as the examination of a still greater delinquent was expected by many to have a similar termination. Mr. Eilaby, whose high office and deep responsibilities should have kept him honest, even had native principle been insufficient, was very justly regarded as perhaps the greatest criminal of all. His case was entered into on the day succeeding the acquittal of Mr. Stanhope. Great excitement prevailed, and the lobbies and avenues of the House were beset by crowds, impatient to know the result. The debate lasted the whole day. Mr. Eilaby found few friends. His guilt was so apparent and so heinous that nobody had courage to stand up in his favor. It was finally resolved, without a dissentient voice, that Mr. Eilaby had encouraged and promoted the destructive execution of the South Sea scheme with a view to his own exorbitant profit, and had combined with the directors in their pernicious practices to the ruin of the public trade and credit of the kingdom. That he should for his offences be ignominiously expelled from the House of Commons and committed a close prisoner to the Tower of London, that he should be restrained from going out of the kingdom for a whole year, or till the end of the next session of Parliament, and that he should make out a correct account of all his estate, in order that it might be applied to the relief of those who had suffered by his malpractices. This verdict caused the greatest joy. Though it was delivered at 12:30 at night, it soon spread over the city. Several persons illuminated their houses in token of their joy. On the following day, when Mr. Eilaby was conveyed to the Tower, the mob assembled on Tower Hill with the intention of hooting and pelting him. Not succeeding in this, they kindled a large bonfire and danced around it in the exuberance of their delight. Several bonfires were made in other places. London presented the appearance of a holiday, and people congratulated one another as if they had just escaped from some great calamity. The rage upon the acquittal of Mr. Stanhope had grown to such a height that none could tell where it would have ended had Mr. Eilaby met with the like indulgence. To increase the public satisfaction, Sir George Caswall of the firm Turner Caswall and Company was expelled from the House on the following day, committed to the Tower, and ordered to refund the sum of £250,000. That part of the report of the Committee of Secrecy which related to the Earl of Sunderland was next taken into consideration. Every effort was made to clear his lordship from the imputation. As the case against him rested chiefly on the evidence extorted from Sir John Blunt, great pains were taken to make it appear that Sir John's word was not to be believed, especially in a matter affecting the honor of a peer and privy councillor. All the friends of the ministry rallied around the Earl, it being generally reported that a verdict of guilty against him would bring a Tory ministry into power. He was eventually acquitted by a majority of 233 against 172. But the country was convinced of his guilt. The greatest indignation was everywhere expressed, and menacing mobs again assembled in London. Happily, no disturbance took place. This was the day on which Mr. Craggs the elder expired. The morrow had been appointed for the consideration of his case. It was very generally believed that he had poisoned himself. It appeared, however, that grief for the loss of his son, one of the secretaries of the Treasury, who had died 5 weeks previously of the smallpox, preyed much on his mind. For this son, dearly beloved, he had been amassing vast heaps of riches. He had been getting money, but not honestly, and he for whose sake he had bartered his honor and sullied his fame was now no more. The dread of further exposure increased his trouble of mind and ultimately brought on an apoplectic fit, in which he expired. He left a fortune of £1.5 million, which was afterwards confiscated for the benefit of the sufferers by the unhappy delusion he had been so mainly instrumental in raising. One by one the case of every director of the company was taken into consideration. A sum amounting to £2,014,000 was confiscated from their estates towards repairing the mischief they had done, each man being allowed a certain residue in proportion to his conduct and circumstances, with which he might begin the world anew. Sir John Blunt was only allowed £5,000 out of his fortune of upwards of £183,000. Sir John Fellowes was allowed £10,000 out of £243,000. Sir Theodore Janssen, £50,000 out of £243,000. Mr. Edward Gibbon, £10,000 out of £106,000. Sir John Lambert, £5,000 out of £72,000. Others, less deeply involved, were treated with greater liberality. Gibbon, the historian whose grandfather was the Mr. Edward Gibbon so severely mulcted, has given in the Memoirs of His Life and Writings an interesting account of the proceedings in Parliament at this time. He owns that he is not an unprejudiced witness, but as all the writers from which it is possible to extract any notice of the proceedings of these disastrous years were prejudiced on the other side, the statements of the great historian become of additional value. If only on the principle audi alteram partem, his opinion is entitled to consideration. In the year 1716, he says, my grandfather was elected one of the directors of the South Sea Company, and his books exhibited the proof that before his acceptance of that fatal office, he had acquired an independent fortune of £60,000. But his fortune was overwhelmed in the shipwreck of the year 1720, and the labors of 30 years were blasted in a single day. Of the use or abuse of the South Sea scheme, of the guilt or innocence of my grandfather and his brother directors, I am neither a competent nor a disinterested judge. Yet the equity of modern times must condemn the violent and arbitrary proceedings, which would have disgraced the cause of justice and rendered injustice still more odious. No sooner had the nation awakened from its golden dream than a popular and even parliamentary clamor demanded its victims, but it was acknowledged on all sides that the directors, however guilty, could not be touched by any known laws of the land. The intemperate notions of Lord Molesworth were not literally acted on, but a bill of pains and penalties was introduced, a retroactive statute to punish the offenses which did not exist at the time they were committed. The legislature restrained the persons of the directors, imposed an exorbitant security for their appearance, and marked their character with a previous note of ignominy. They were compelled to deliver, upon oath, the strict value of their estates, and were disabled from making any transfer or alienation of any part of their property. Against a bill of pains and penalties, it is the common right of every subject to be heard by his counsel at the bar. They prayed to be heard. Their prayer was refused. And their oppressors, who required no evidence, would listen to no defense. It had been at first proposed that 1/8 of their respective estates should be allowed for the future support of the directors, but it was especially urged that, in the various shades of opulence and guilt, such a proportion would be too light for many, and for some might possibly be too heavy. The character and conduct of each man were separately weighed. But instead of the calm solemnity of a judicial inquiry, the fortune and honor of 33 Englishmen were made the topics of hasty conversation, the sport of a lawless majority, and the basest member of the committee, by a malicious word or silent vote, might indulge his general spleen or personal animosity. Injury was aggravated by insult, and insult was embittered by pleasantry. Allowances of £20 or 1 shilling were facetiously moved. A vague report that a director had formerly been concerned in another project by which some unknown persons had lost their money was admitted as a proof of his actual guilt. One man was ruined because he had dropped a foolish speech that his horses should feed upon gold. Another because he was grown so proud that one day at the Treasury he had refused a civil answer to persons much above him. All were condemned, absent and unheard, in arbitrary fines and forfeitures, which swept away the greatest part of their substance. Such bold oppression can scarcely be shielded by the omnipotence of Parliament. My grandfather could not expect to be treated with more lenity than his companions. His Tory principles and connections rendered him obnoxious to the ruling powers. His name was reported in a suspicious secret. His well-known abilities could not plead the excuse of ignorance or error. In the first proceedings against the South Sea directors, Mr. Gibbon was one of the first taken into custody, and in the final sentence, the measure of his fine proclaimed him eminently guilty. The total estimate, which he delivered on oath to the House of Commons, amounted to £106,543.05, exclusive of antecedent settlements. Two different allowances of £15,000 and of £10,000 were moved for Mr. Gibbon. But on the question being put, it was carried without a division for the smaller sum. On these ruins, with the skill and credit of which Parliament had not been able to despoil him, my grandfather, at a mature age, erected the edifice of a new fortune. The labors of 16 years were amply rewarded, and I have reason to believe that the second structure was not much inferior to the first. The next consideration of the legislature, after the punishment of the directors, was to restore public credit. The scheme of Walpole had been found insufficient, and had fallen into disrepute. A computation was made of the whole capital stock of the South Sea Company at the end of the year 1720. It was found to amount to £37,800,000, of which the stock allotted to all the proprietors only amounted to £24,500,000. The remainder of £13,300,000 belonged to the company in their corporate capacity and was the profit they had made by the national delusion. Upwards of 8 millions of this were taken from the company and divided among the proprietors and subscribers generally, making a dividend of about £33.06.08 per cent. This was a great relief. It was further ordered that such persons as had borrowed money from the South Sea Company upon stock actually transferred and pledged at the time of borrowing to or for the use of the company, should be free from all demands upon payment of 10% of the sums so borrowed. They had lent about 11 millions in this manner at a time when prices were unnaturally raised, and they now received back 1,100,000 when prices had sunk to their ordinary level. But it was a long time before public credit was thoroughly restored. Enterprise, like Icarus, had soared too high and melted the wax of her wings. Like Icarus, she had fallen into a sea and learned while floundering in its waves that her proper element was the solid ground. She has never since attempted so high a flight. In times of great commercial prosperity, there has been a tendency to overspeculation on several occasions since then. The success of one project generally produces others of a similar kind. Popular imitativeness will always, in a trading nation, seize hold of such successes and drag a community too anxious for profits into an abyss from which extrication is difficult. Bubble companies of a kind similar to those engendered by the South Sea Project lived their little day in the famous year of the Panic, 1825. On that occasion, as in 1720, knavery gathered a rich harvest from cupidity, but both suffered when the day of reckoning came. The schemes of the year 1836 threatened at one time results as disastrous, but they were happily averted before it was too late. The South Sea Project remained until 1845 the greatest example in British history of the infatuation of the people for commercial gambling. The first edition of these volumes was published some time before the outbreak of the great railway mania of that and the following year. The Tulipomania. Quis furor, o cives? Lucan. The tulip, so named, it is said, from a Turkish word, signifying a turban, was introduced into Western Europe about the middle of the 16th century. Conrad Gessner, who claims the merit of having brought it into repute, little dreaming of the commotion it was shortly afterwards to make in the world, says that he first saw it in the year 1559 in a garden at Augsburg, belonging to the learned Councillor Herwart, a man very famous in his day for his collection of rare exotics. The bulbs were sent to this gentleman by a friend at Constantinople, where the flower had long been a favorite. In the course of 10 or 11 years after this period, tulips were much sought after by the wealthy, especially in Holland and Germany. Rich people at Amsterdam sent for the bulbs direct to Constantinople and paid the most extravagant prices for them. The first roots planted in England were brought from Vienna in 1600. Until the year 1634, the tulip annually increased in reputation until it was deemed a proof of bad taste in any man of fortune to be without a collection of them. Many learned men, including Pompeius de Angelis and the celebrated Lipsius of Leiden, the author of the treatise De Constantia, were passionately fond of tulips. The rage for possessing them soon caught the middle classes of society, and merchants and shopkeepers, even of moderate means, began to vie with each other in the rarity of these flowers and the preposterous prices they paid for them. A trader at Haarlem was known to pay one half of his fortune for a single root, not with the design of selling it again at a profit, but to keep in his own conservatory for the admiration of his acquaintance. One would suppose that there must have been some great virtue in this flower to have made it so valuable in the eyes of so prudent a people as the Dutch. But it has neither the beauty nor the perfume of the rose, hardly the beauty of the sweet, sweet pea. Neither is it as enduring as either. Cowley, it is true, is loud in its praise. He says, "The tulip next appeared, all over gay, but wanton, full of pride and full of play. The world can't show a dye, but here has place. Nay, by new mixtures, she can change her face. Purple and gold are both beneath her care, the richest needlework she loves to wear. Her only study is to please the eye, and to outshine the rest in finery." This, though not very poetical, is the description of a poet. Beckmann, in his History of Inventions, paints it with more fidelity and in prose more pleasing than Cowley's poetry. He says, "There are few plants which acquire, through accident, weakness, or disease, so many variegations as the tulip. When uncultivated and in its natural state, it is almost of one color, has large leaves, and an extraordinarily long stem. When it has been weakened by cultivation, it becomes more agreeable in the eyes of the florist. The petals are then paler, smaller, and more diversified in hue, and the leaves acquire a softer green color. Thus this masterpiece of culture, the more beautiful it turns, grows so much the weaker, so that with the greatest skill and most careful attention it can scarcely be transplanted or even kept alive. Many persons grow insensibly attached to that which gives them a great deal of trouble, as a mother often loves her sick and ever-ailing child better than her more healthy offspring. Upon the same principle, we must account for the unmerited encomia lavished upon these fragile blossoms. In 1634, the rage among the Dutch to possess them was so great that the ordinary industry of the country was neglected, and the population, even to its lowest dregs, embarked in the tulip trade. As the mania increased, prices augmented until, in the year 1635, many persons were known to invest a fortune of 100,000 florins in the purchase of 40 roots. It then became necessary to sell them by their weight in perits, a small weight less than a grain. A tulip of the species called Admiral Liefken, weighing 400 perits, was worth 4,400 florins. An Admiral van der Eyck, weighing 446 perits, was worth 1,260 florins. A Childer of 106 perits was worth 1,615 florins. A Viceroy of 400 perits, 3,000 florins. And most precious of all, a Semper Augustus, weighing 200 perits, was thought to be very cheap at 5,500 florins. The latter was much sought after, and even an inferior bulb might command a price of 2,000 florins. It is related that at one time, early in 1636, there were only two roots of this description to be had in all Holland, and those not of the best. One was in the possession of a dealer in Amsterdam, the other in Haarlem. So anxious were the speculators to obtain them that one person offered the fee simple of 12 acres of building ground for the Haarlem tulip. That of Amsterdam was bought for 4,600 florins, a new carriage, two gray horses, and a complete suit of harness. Hunting, an industrious author of that day who wrote a folio volume of 1,000 pages upon the tulipomania, has preserved the folio wing list of the various articles and their value, which were delivered for one single root of the rare species called the Viceroy. 2 lasts of wheat, 448 florins. 4 lasts of rye, 558 florins. 4 fat oxen, 480 florins. 8 fat swine, 240 florins. 12 fat sheep, 120 florins. 2 hogsheads of wine, 70 florins. 4 tons of beer, 32 florins. 2 tons of butter, 192 florins. 1,000 pounds of cheese, 120 florins. A complete bed, 100 florins. A suit of clothes, 80 florins. A silver drinking cup, 60 florins. Total, 2,500 florins. People who had been absent from Holland, and whose chance it was to return when this folly was at its maximum, were sometimes led into awkward dilemmas by their ignorance. There is an amusing instance of the kind related in Blainville's Travels. A wealthy merchant, who prided himself not a little on his rare tulips, received upon one occasion a very valuable consignment of merchandise from the Levant. Intelligence of its arrival was brought him by a sailor, who presented himself for that purpose at the counting-house among bales of goods of every description. The merchant, to reward him for his news, munificently made him a present of a fine red herring for his breakfast. The sailor had, it appears, a great partiality for onions, and seeing a bulb very like an onion lying upon the counter of this liberal trader, and thinking it, no doubt, very much out of its place among silks and velvets, he slyly seized an opportunity and slipped it into his pocket as a relish for his herring. He got clear off with his prize and proceeded to the quay to eat his breakfast. Hardly was his back turned when the merchant missed his valuable Semper Augustus, worth 3,000 florins, or about 280 pounds sterling. The whole establishment was instantly in an uproar. Search was everywhere made for the precious root, but it was not to be found. Great was the merchant's distress of mind. The search was renewed, but again without success. At last someone thought of the sailor. The unhappy merchant sprang into the street at the bare suggestion. His alarmed household followed him. The sailor, simple soul, had not thought of concealment. He was found quietly sitting on a coil of ropes, masticating the last morsel of his onion. Little did he dream that he had been eating a breakfast whose cost might have regaled a whole ship's crew for a twelvemonth, or, as the plundered merchant himself expressed it, might have sumptuously feasted the Prince of Orange and the whole court of the Stadtholder. Anthony caused pearls to be dissolved in wine to drink the health of Cleopatra. Sir Richard Whittington was as foolishly magnificent in an entertainment to King Henry V, and Sir Thomas Gresham drank a diamond dissolved in wine to the health of Queen Elizabeth when she opened the Royal Exchange. But the breakfast of this roguish Dutchman was as splendid as either. He had an advantage, too, over his wasteful predecessors. Their gems did not improve the taste or the wholesomeness of their wine, while his tulip was quite delicious with his red herring. The most unfortunate part of the business for him was that he remained in prison for some months on a charge of felony, preferred against him by the merchant. Another story is told of an English traveler, which is scarcely less ludicrous. This gentleman, an amateur botanist, happened to see a tulip root lying in the conservatory of a wealthy Dutchman. Being ignorant of its quality, he took out his penknife and peeled off its coats, with the view of making experiments upon it. When it was by this means reduced to half its size, he cut it into two equal sections, making all the time many learned remarks on the singular appearance of the unknown bulb. Suddenly the owner pounced upon him, and with fury in his eyes, asked him if he knew what he had been doing. "Peeling a most extraordinary onion," replied the philosopher. "Hunderttausend Duivel," said the Dutchman. "It's an Admiral van der Eyck." "Thank you," replied the traveler, taking out his notebook to make a memorandum of the same. "Are these admirals common in your country?" "Death and the devil," said the Dutchman, seizing the astonished man of science by the collar. "Come before the syndic and you shall see." In spite of his remonstrances, the traveler was led through the streets followed by a mob of persons. When brought into the presence of the magistrate, he learned, to his consternation, that the root upon which he had been experimentalizing was worth 4,000 florins, and notwithstanding all he could urge in extenuation, he was lodged in prison until he found securities for the payment of this sum. The demand for tulips of a rare species increased so much in the year 1636 that regular marts for their sale were established on the Stock Exchange of Amsterdam, in Rotterdam, Haarlem, Leiden, Alkmaar, Hoorn, and other towns. Symptoms of gambling now became for the first time apparent. The stock jobbers, ever on the alert for a new speculation, dealt largely in tulips, making use of all the means they so well knew how to employ to cause fluctuations in prices. At first, as in all these gambling mania, confidence was at its height, and everybody gained. The tulip jobbers speculated in the rise and fall of the tulip stocks, and made large profits by buying when prices fell and selling out when they rose. Many individuals grew suddenly rich. A golden bait hung temptingly out before the people, and one after the other they rushed to the tulip marts like flies around a honey pot. Everyone imagined that the passion for tulips would last forever, and that the wealthy from every part of the world would send to Holland and pay whatever prices were asked for them. The riches of Europe would be concentrated on the shores of the Zuider Zee, and poverty banished from the favored clime of Holland. Nobles, citizens, farmers, mechanics, seamen, footmen, maidservants, even chimney sweeps and old clothes women dabbled in tulips. People of all grades converted their property into cash and invested it in flowers. Houses and lands were offered for sale at ruinously low prices, or assigned in payment of bargains made at the tulip mart. Foreigners became smitten with the same frenzy, and money poured into Holland from all directions. The prices of the necessaries of life rose again by degrees. Houses and lands, horses and carriages, and luxuries of every sort rose in value with them, and for some months Holland seemed the very antechamber of Plutus. The operations of the trade became so extensive and so intricate that it was found necessary to draw up a code of laws for the guidance of the dealers. Notaries and clerks were also appointed, who devoted themselves exclusively to the interests of the trade. The designation of public notary was hardly known in some towns, that of tulip notary usurping its place. In the smaller towns, where there was no exchange, the principal tavern was usually selected as the show place, where high and low traded in tulips and confirmed their bargains over sumptuous entertainments. These dinners were sometimes attended by 200 or 300 persons, and large vases of tulips in full bloom were placed at regular intervals upon the tables and sideboards for their gratification during the repast. At last, however, the more prudent began to see that this folly could not last forever. Rich people no longer bought the flowers to keep them in their gardens, but to sell them again at 10% profit. It was seen that somebody must lose fearfully in the end. As this conviction spread, prices fell and never rose again. Confidence was destroyed, and a universal panic seized upon the dealers. A had agreed to purchase 10 Semper Augustans from B at 4,000 florins each at 6 weeks after the signing of the contract. B was ready with the flowers at the appointed time, but the price had fallen to 300 or 400 florins, and A refused either to pay the difference or receive the tulips. Defaulters were announced day after day in all the towns of Holland. Hundreds who, a few months previously, had begun to doubt that there was such a thing as poverty in the land, suddenly found themselves the possessors of a few bulbs which nobody would buy, even though they offered them at 1/4 of the sums they had paid for them. The cry of distress resounded everywhere, and each man accused his neighbor. The few who had contrived to enrich themselves hid their wealth from the knowledge of their fellow citizens and invested it in the English or other funds. Many who, for a brief season, had emerged from humbler walks of life were cast back into their original obscurity. Substantial merchants were reduced almost to beggary, and many a representative of a noble line saw the fortunes of his house ruined beyond redemption. When the first alarm subsided, the tulip holders in the several towns held public meetings to devise what measures were best to be taken to restore public credit. It was generally agreed that deputies should be sent from all parts to Amsterdam to consult with the government upon some remedy for the evil. The government at first refused to interfere, but advised the tulip holders to agree to some plan among themselves. Several meetings were held for this purpose, but no measure could be devised likely to give satisfaction to the deluded people, or repair even a slight portion of the mischief that had been done. The language of complaint and reproach was in everybody's mouth, and all the meetings were of the most stormy character. At last, however, after much bickering and ill will, it was agreed at Amsterdam by the assembled deputies that all contracts made in the height of the mania, or prior to the month of November 1636, should be declared null and void, and that in those made after that date, purchasers should be freed from their engagements on paying 10% to the vendor. This decision gave no satisfaction. The vendors who had their tulips on hand were, of course, discontented, and those who had pledged themselves to purchase thought themselves hardly treated. Tulips which had at one time been worth 6,000 florins were now to be procured for 500, so that the composition of 10% was 100 florins more than the actual value. Actions for breach of contract were threatened in all the courts of the country, but the latter refused to take cognizance of gambling transactions. The matter was finally referred to the Provincial Council at The Hague, and it was confidently expected that the wisdom of this body would invent some measure by which credit should be restored. Expectation was on the stretch for its decision, but it never came. The members continued to deliberate week after week, and at last, after thinking about it for 3 months, declared that they could offer no final decision until they had more information. They advised, however, that in the meantime, every vendor should, in the presence of witnesses, offer the tulips in natura to the purchaser for the sums agreed upon. If the latter refused to take them, they might be put up for sale by public auction, and the original contractor held responsible for the difference between the actual and the stipulated price. This was exactly the plan recommended by the deputies, and which was already shown to be of no avail. There was no court in Holland which would enforce payment. The question was raised in Amsterdam, but the judges unanimously refused to interfere, on the ground that debts contracted in gambling were no debts in law. Thus the matter rested. To find a remedy was beyond the power of the government. Those who were unlucky enough to have had stores of tulips on hand at the time of the sudden reaction were left to bear their ruin as philosophically as they could. Those who had made profits were allowed to keep them. But the commerce of the country suffered a severe shock from which it was many years ere it recovered. The example of the Dutch was imitated to some extent in England. In the year 1636, tulips were publicly sold in the Exchange of London, and the jobbers exerted themselves to the utmost to raise them to the fictitious value they had acquired in Amsterdam. In Paris also the jobbers strove to create a tulipomania. In both cities they only partially succeeded. However, the force of example brought the flowers into great favor, and amongst a certain class of people, tulips have ever since been prized more highly than any other flowers of the field. The Dutch are still notorious for their partiality to them, and continue to pay higher prices for them than any other people. As the rich Englishman boasts of his fine racehorses or his old pictures, so does the wealthy Dutchman vaunt him of his tulips. In England, in our day, strange as it may appear, a tulip will produce more money than an oak. If one could be found, rara in terris, and black as the black swan of Juvenal, its price would equal that of a dozen acres of standing corn. In Scotland, towards the close of the 17th century, the highest price for tulips, according to the authority of a writer in the supplement to the third edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, was 10 guineas. Their value appears to have diminished from that time till the year 1769, when the two most valuable species in England were the Don Quevedo and the Valentinier, the former of which was worth 2 guineas and the latter 2.5 guineas. These prices appear to have been the minimum. In the year 1800, a common price was 15 guineas for a single bulb. In 1835, a bulb of the species called the Miss Fanny Kemble was sold by public auction in London for £75. Still more remarkable was the price of a tulip in the possession of a gardener in the King's Road, Chelsea. In his catalogues, it was labelled at 200 guineas. The Alchemists, or searchers for the philosopher's stone and the water of life. Mercury, loquitur. The mischief, a secret any of them know, above the consuming of coals and drawing of usquebaugh. Howsoever they may pretend, under the specious names of Geber, Arnold, Lully, or Bombast of Hohenheim, to commit miracles in art and treason against nature. As if the title of philosopher, that creature of glory, were to be fetched out of a furnace. I am their crude and their sublimate, their precipitate and their unctions, their male and their female, sometimes their hermaphrodite. What they list to style me! They will calcine you a grave matron, as it might be a mother of the maids, and spring up a young virgin out of her ashes, as fresh as a phoenix, lay you an old courtier on the coals, like a sausage or a bloat herring, and after they have broiled him enough, blow a soul into him with a pair of bellows. See, they begin to muster again and draw their forces out against me. The genius of the place defend me. Ben Jonson's Mask. Mercury vindicated from the alchemists. Dissatisfaction with his lot seems to be the characteristic of man in all ages and climates. So far, however, from being an evil, as at first might be supposed, it has been the great civilizer of our race, and has tended, more than anything else, to raise us above the condition of the brutes. But the same discontent which has been the source of all improvement has been the parent of no small progeny of follies and absurdities. To trace these latter is our present object. Vast as the subject appears, it is easily reducible within such limits as will make it comprehensive without being wearisome, and render its study both instructive and amusing. Three causes especially have excited the discontent of mankind, and, by impelling us to seek for remedies for the irremediable, have bewildered us in a maze of madness and error. These are death, toil, and ignorance of the future. The doom of man upon this sphere, and for which he shows his antipathy by his love of life, his longing for abundance, and his craving curiosity to pierce the secrets of the days to come. The first has led many to imagine that they might find means to avoid death, or, failing in this, that they might nevertheless so prolong existence as to reckon it by centuries instead of units. From this sprang the search, so long continued and still pursued, for the elixir vitae, or water of life, which has led thousands to pretend to it and millions to believe in it. From the second sprang the search for the philosopher's stone, which was to create plenty by changing all metals into gold. And from the third, the false sciences of astrology, divination, and their divisions of necromancy, chiromancy, augury, with all their train of signs, portents, and omens. In tracing the career of the erring philosophers or the willful cheats who have encouraged or preyed upon the credulity of mankind, it will simplify and elucidate the subject if we divide it into three classes. The first comprising alchemists, or those in general who have devoted themselves to the discovering of the philosopher's stone and the water of life. The second comprising astrologers, necromancers, sorcerers, geomancers, and all those who pretended to discover futurity. And the third consisting of the dealers in charms, amulets, philters, universal panacea mongers, touchers for the evil, seventh sons of a seventh son, sympathetic powder compounders, homeopathists, animal magnetizers, and all the motley tribe of quacks, empirics, and charlatans. But in narrating the career of such men, it will be found that many of them united several or all of the functions just mentioned. That the alchemist was a fortune-teller or a necromancer, that he pretended to cure all maladies by touch or charm, and to work miracles of every kind. In the dark and early ages of European history, this is more especially the case. Even as we advance to more recent periods, we shall find great difficulty in separating the characters. The alchemist seldom confined himself strictly to his pretended science. The sorcerer and necromancer to theirs, or the medical charlatan to his. Beginning with alchemy, some confusion of these classes is unavoidable, but the ground will clear for us as we advance. Let us not, in the pride of our superior knowledge, turn with contempt from the follies of our predecessors. The study of the errors into which great minds have fallen in the pursuit of truth can never be uninstructive. As the man looks back to the days of his childhood and his youth and recalls to his mind the strange notions and false opinions that swayed his actions at that time, that he may wonder at them, so should society, for its edification, look back to the opinions which governed the ages fled. He is but a superficial thinker who would despise and refuse to hear of them merely because they are absurd. No man is so wise but that he may learn some wisdom from his past errors, either of thought or action. And no society has made such advances as to be capable of no improvement from the retrospect of its past folly and credulity. And not only is such a study instructive, he who reads for amusement only will find no chapter in the annals of the human mind more amusing than this. It opens out the whole realm of fiction, the wild, the fantastic, and the wonderful, and all the immense variety of things that are not and cannot be, but that have been imagined and believed. For more than 1,000 years, the art of alchemy captivated many noble spirits and was believed in by millions. Its origin is involved in obscurity. Some of its devotees have claimed for it an antiquity coeval with the creation of man himself. Others, again, would trace it no further back than the time of Noah. Vincent de Beauvais argues, indeed, that all the antediluvians must have possessed a knowledge of alchemy, and particularly cites Noah as having been acquainted with the elixir vitae, or he could not have lived to so prodigious an age, and have begotten children when upwards of 500. Longlet Dufresnoy, in his History of the Hermetic Philosophy, says, most of them pretended that Shem, or Chem, the son of Noah, was an adept in the art, and thought it highly probable that the words chemistry and alchemy are both derived from his name. Others say the art was derived from the Egyptians, amongst whom it was first founded by Hermes Trismegistus. Moses, who was looked upon as a first-rate alchemist, gained his knowledge in Egypt, but he kept it all to himself and would not instruct the children of Israel in its mysteries. All the writers upon alchemy triumphantly cite the story of the golden calf in the 32nd chapter of Exodus, to prove that this great lawgiver was an adept, and could make or unmake gold at his pleasure. It is recorded that Moses was so wrath with the Israelites for their idolatry that he took the calf which they had made and burned it in the fire and ground it to powder and strewed it upon the water and made the children of Israel drink of it. This, say the alchemists, he never could have done had he not been in possession of the philosopher's stone. By no other means could he have made the powder of gold float upon the water. But we must leave this knotty point for the consideration of the adepts in the art, if any such there be, and come to more modern periods of its history. The Jesuit, Father Martini, in his Historia Sinica, says it was practiced by the Chinese 2,500 years before the birth of Christ. But his assertion, being unsupported, is worth nothing. It would appear, however, that pretenders to the art of making gold and silver existed in Rome in the first centuries after the Christian era, and that, when discovered, they were liable to punishment as knaves and impostors. At Constantinople in the 4th century, the transmutation of metals was very generally believed in, and many of the Greek ecclesiastics wrote treatises upon the subject. Their names are preserved and some notice of their works given in the 3rd volume of Longlet Dufresnoy's History of the Hermetic Philosophy. Their notion appears to have been that all metals were composed of two substances, the one metallic earth and the other a red inflammable matter, which they called sulfur. The pure union of these substances formed gold, but other metals were mixed with and contaminated by various foreign ingredients. The object of the philosopher's stone was to dissolve or neutralize all these ingredients, by which iron, lead, copper, and all metals would be transmuted into the original gold. Many learned and clever men wasted their time, their health, and their energies in this vain pursuit, but for several centuries it took no great hold upon the imagination of the people. The history of the delusion appears in a manner lost from this time till the 8th century, when it appeared amongst the Arabians. From this period it becomes easier to trace its progress. A master then appeared, who was long looked upon as the father of the science, and whose name is indissolubly connected with it. Geber. Of this philosopher who devoted his life to the study of alchemy, but few particulars are known. He is thought to have lived in the year 730. His true name was Abu Musa Jafar, to which was added Al-Sofi, or the Wise, and he was born at Huran in Mesopotamia. Some have thought he was a Greek, others a Spaniard, and others a prince of Hindustan. But of all the mistakes which have been made respecting him, the most ludicrous was that made by the French translator of Sprenger's History of Medicine, who thought from the sound of his name that he was a German and rendered it as the donateur, or giver. No details of his life are known, but it is asserted that he wrote more than 500 works upon the philosopher's stone and the water of life. He was a great enthusiast in his art, and compared the incredulous to little children shut up in a narrow room without windows or aperture, who, because they saw nothing beyond, denied the existence of the great globe itself. He thought that a preparation of gold would cure all maladies, not only in man, but in the inferior animals and plants. He also imagined that all the metals labored under disease, with the exception of gold, which was the only one in perfect health. He affirmed that the secret of the philosopher's stone had been more than once discovered, but that the ancient and wise men who had hit upon it would never, by word or writing, communicate it to men because of their unworthiness and incredulity. His sum of perfection or instructions to students to aid them in the laborious search for the stone and elixir has been translated into most of the languages of Europe. An English translation by a great enthusiast in alchemy, one Richard Russell, was published in London in 1686. The preface is dated 8 years previously from the House of the Alchemist at the Star in Newmarket in Wapping near the dock. His design in undertaking the translation was, as he informs us, to expose the false pretenses of the many ignorant pretenders to the science who abounded in his day. But the life of Geber, though spent in the pursuit of this vain chimera, was not altogether useless. He stumbled upon discoveries which he did not seek, and science is indebted to him for the first mention of corrosive sublimate, the red oxide of mercury, nitric acid, and the nitrate of silver. For more than 200 years after the death of Geber, the Arabian philosophers devoted themselves to the study of alchemy, joining with it that of astrology. Of these, the most celebrated was Al-Farabi. Al-Farabi flourished at the commencement of the 10th century and enjoyed the reputation of being one of the most learned men of his age. He spent his life in traveling from country to country that he might gather the opinions of philosophers upon the great secrets of nature. No danger dismayed him, no toil wearied him of the pursuit. Many sovereigns endeavored to retain him at their courts, but he refused to rest until he had discovered the great object of his life, the art of preserving it for centuries, and of making gold as much as he needed. This wandering mode of life at last proved fatal to him. He had been on a visit to Mecca, not so much for religious as for philosophical purposes, when, returning through Syria, he stopped at the court of Sultan Seyf ed-Dowleh, who was renowned as the patron of learning. He presented himself in his traveling attire in the presence of that monarch and his courtiers, and without invitation, coolly sat himself down on the sofa beside the prince. The courtiers and wise men were indignant, and the sultan, who did not know the intruder, was at first inclined to follow their example. He turned to one of his officers and ordered him to eject the presumptuous stranger from the room. But Al-Farabi, without moving, dared them to lay hands upon him, and, turning himself calmly to the prince, remarked that he did not know who was his guest, or he would treat him with honor, not with violence. The sultan, instead of being still further incensed, as many potentates would have been, admired his coolness, and, requesting him to sit still closer to him on the sofa, entered into a long conversation with him upon science and divine philosophy. All the court were charmed with the stranger. Questions for discussion were propounded, on all of which he showed superior knowledge. He convinced everyone who ventured to dispute with him, and spoke so eloquently upon the science of alchemy that he was at once recognized as only second to the great Geber himself. One of the doctors present inquired whether a man who knew so many sciences was acquainted with music. Al-Farabi made no reply, but merely requested that a lute should be brought him. The lute was brought, and he played such ravishing and tender melodies that all the court were melted into tears. He then changed his theme and played airs so sprightly that he set the grave philosophers, sultan and all, dancing as fast as their legs could carry them. He then sobered them again by a mournful strain and made them sob and sigh as if broken-hearted. The sultan, highly delighted with his powers, entreated him to stay, offering him every inducement that wealth, power, and dignity could supply. But the alchemist resolutely refused, it being decreed, he said, that he should never repose till he had discovered the philosopher's stone. He set out accordingly the same evening, and was murdered by some thieves in the deserts of Syria. His biographers give no further particulars of his life beyond mentioning that he wrote several valuable treatises on his art, all of which, however, have been lost. His death happened in the year 954. Avicenna. Avicenna, whose real name was Ibn Sina, another great alchemist, was born at Bukhara in 980. His reputation as a physician and a man skilled in all sciences was so great that the Sultan Magdal-Dulet resolved to try his powers in the great science of government. He was accordingly made Grand Vizier of that prince and ruled the state with some advantage, but in a science still more difficult, he failed completely. He could not rule his own passions, but gave himself up to wine and women and led a life of shameless debauchery. Amid the multifarious pursuits of business and pleasure, he nevertheless found time to write seven treatises upon the philosopher's stone, which were for many ages looked upon as of great value by pretenders to the art. It is rare that an eminent physician, as Avicenna appears to have been, abandons himself to sensual gratification, but so completely did he become enthralled in the course of a few years that he was dismissed from his high office, and died shortly afterwards of premature old age and a complication of maladies brought on by debauchery. His death took place in the year 1036. After his time, few philosophers of any note in Arabia are heard of as devoting themselves to the study of alchemy, but it began shortly afterwards to attract greater attention in Europe. Learned men in France, England, Spain, and Italy expressed their belief in the science, and many devoted their whole energies to it. In the 12th and 13th centuries especially, it was extensively pursued, and some of the brightest names of that age are connected with it. Among the most eminent of them are Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas. The first of these philosophers was born in the year 1193 of a noble family at Lavingen in the Duchy of Neuburg, on the Danube. For the first 30 years of his life he appeared remarkably dull and stupid, and it was feared by everyone that no good could come of him. He entered a Dominican monastery at an early age, but made so little progress in his studies that he was more than once upon the point of abandoning them in despair, but he was endowed with extraordinary perseverance. As he advanced to middle age, his mind expanded, and he learned whatever he applied himself to with extreme facility. So remarkable a change was not in that age to be accounted for but by a miracle. It was asserted and believed that the Holy Virgin, touched with his great desire to become learned and famous, took pity upon his incapacity, and appeared to him in the cloister where he sat almost despairing, and asked him whether he wished to excel in philosophy or divinity. He chose philosophy, to the chagrin of the Virgin, who reproached him in mild and sorrowful accents that he had not made a better choice. She, however, granted his request that he should become the most excellent philosopher of the age, but set this drawback to his pleasure, that he should relapse, when at the height of his fame, into his former incapacity and stupidity. Albertus never took the trouble to contradict the story, but prosecuted his studies with such unremitting zeal that his reputation speedily spread over all Europe. In the year 1244, the celebrated Thomas Aquinas placed himself under his tuition. Many extraordinary stories are told of the master and his pupil. While they paid all due attention to other branches of science, they never neglected the pursuit of the philosopher's stone and the elixir vitae. Although they discovered neither, it was believed that Albert had seized upon some portion of the secret of life and found means to animate a brazen statue, upon the formation of which, under proper conjunctions of the planets, he had been occupied many years of his life. He and Thomas Aquinas completed it together, endowed it with the faculty of speech, and made it perform the functions of a domestic servant. In this capacity it was exceedingly useful, but through some defect in the machinery it chattered much more than was agreeable to either philosopher. Various remedies were tried to cure it of its garrulity, but in vain, and one day Thomas Aquinas was so enraged at the noise it made when he was in the midst of a mathematical problem that he seized a ponderous hammer and smashed it to pieces. He was sorry afterwards for what he had done, and was reproved by his master for giving way to his anger, so unbecoming in a philosopher. They made no attempt to reanimate the statue. Such stories as these show the spirit of the age. Every great man who attempted to study the secrets of nature was thought a magician, and it is not to be wondered at that when philosophers themselves pretended to discover an elixir for conferring immortality or a red stone which was to create boundless wealth, that popular opinion should have enhanced upon their pretensions and have endowed them with powers still more miraculous. It was believed of Albertus Magnus that he could even change the course of the seasons, a feat which the many thought less difficult than the discovery of the grand elixir. Albertus was desirous of obtaining a piece of ground on which to build a monastery in the neighborhood of Cologne. The ground belonged to William, Count of Holland, and King of the Romans, who for some reason or other did not wish to part with it. Albertus is reported to have gained it by the following extraordinary method. He invited the prince, as he was passing through Cologne, to a magnificent entertainment prepared for him and all his court. The prince accepted it, and repaired with a lordly retinue to the residence of the sage. It was in the midst of winter, the Rhine was frozen over, and the cold was so bitter that the knights could not sit on horseback without running the risk of losing their toes by the frost. Great, therefore, was their surprise on arriving at Albert's house to find that the repast was spread in his garden, in which snow had drifted to the depth of several feet. The earl, in high dudgeon, remounted his steed, but Albert at last prevailed upon him to take his seat at the table. He had no sooner done so than the dark clouds rolled away from the sky, a warm sun shone forth, the cold north wind veered suddenly round, and blew a mild breeze from the south. The snows melted away. The ice was unbound upon the streams, and the trees put forth their green leaves and their fruit. Flowers sprang up beneath their feet, while larks, nightingales, blackbirds, cuckoos, thrushes, and every sweet songbird sang hymns from every tree. The earl and his attendants wondered greatly, but they ate their dinner, and in recompense for it, Albert got his piece of ground to build a convent on. He had not, however, shown them all his power. Immediately that the repast was over, he gave the word, and dark clouds obscured the sun. The snow fell in large flakes, the singing birds fell dead, the leaves dropped from the trees, and the winds blew so cold and howled so mournfully that the guests wrapped themselves up in their thick cloaks and retreated into the house to warm themselves at the blazing fire in Albert's kitchen. Thomas Aquinas also could work wonders as well as his master. It is related of him that he lodged in a street at Cologne, where he was much annoyed by the incessant clatter made by the horses' hoofs, as they were led through it daily to exercise by their grooms. He had entreated the latter to select some other spot, where they might not disturb a philosopher, but the grooms turned a deaf ear to all his solicitations. In this emergency he had recourse to the aid of magic. He constructed a small horse of bronze, upon which he inscribed certain cabalistic characters, and buried it at midnight in the midst of the highway. The next morning a troop of grooms came riding along as usual, but the horses, as they arrived at the spot where the magic horse was buried, reared and plunged violently, their nostrils distended with terror, their manes grew erect, and the perspiration ran down their sides in streams. In vain the riders applied the spur. In vain they coaxed or threatened. The animals would not pass the spot. On the following day their success was no better. They were at length compelled to seek another spot for their exercise, and Thomas Aquinas was left in peace. Albertus Magnus was made Bishop of Ratisbon in 1259, but he occupied the see only 4 years when he resigned, on the ground that its duties occupied too much of the time which he was anxious to devote to philosophy. He died in Cologne in 1280 at the advanced age of 87. The Dominican writers deny that he ever sought the philosopher's stone, but his treatise upon minerals sufficiently proves that he did. Artifius. Artifius, a name noted in the annals of alchemy, was born in the early part of the 12th century. He wrote two famous treatises, the one upon the philosopher's stone and the other on the art of prolonging human life. In the latter, he vaunts his great qualifications for instructing mankind on such a matter, as he was at that time in the 1025th year of his age. He had many disciples who believed in his extreme age, and who attempted to prove that he was Apollonius of Tyana, who lived soon after the advent of Jesus Christ, and the particulars of whose life and pretended miracles have been so fully described by Philostratus. He took care never to contradict a story which so much increased the power he was desirous of wielding over his fellow mortals. On all convenient occasions he boasted of it, and having an excellent memory, a fertile imagination, and a thorough knowledge of all existing history, he was never at a loss for an answer when questioned as to the personal appearance, the manners, or the character of the great men of antiquity. He also pretended to have found the philosopher's stone, and said that, in search of it, he had descended to hell and seen the devil sitting on a throne of gold, with a legion of imps and fiends around him. His works on alchemy have been translated into French, and were published in Paris in 1609 or 1610. Alain de Lille. Contemporary with Albertus Magnus was Alain de Lille of Flanders, who was named, from his great learning, the Universal Doctor. He was thought to possess a knowledge of all the sciences, and, like Artifius, to have discovered the elixir vitae. He became one of the friars of the Abbey of Citeaux, and died in 1298, aged about 110 years. It was said of him that he was at the point of death when in his 50th year, but that the fortunate discovery of the elixir enabled him to add 60 years to his existence. He wrote a commentary on the prophecies of Merlin. Arnold de Villeneuve. This philosopher has left a much greater reputation. He was born in the year 1245, and studied medicine with great success in the University of Paris. He afterwards traveled for 20 years in Italy and Germany, where he made acquaintance with Pietro d'Apone, a man of a character akin to his own and addicted to the same pursuits. As a physician, he was thought in his own lifetime to be the most able the world had ever seen. Like all the learned men of that day, he dabbled in astrology and alchemy and was thought to have made immense quantities of gold from lead and copper. When Pietro d'Apone was arrested in Italy and brought to trial as a sorcerer, a similar accusation was made against Arnold. But he managed to leave the country in time and escape the fate of his unfortunate friend. He lost some credit by predicting the end of the world, but afterwards regained it. The time of his death is not exactly known, but it must have been prior to the year 1311. When Pope Clement V wrote a circular letter to all the clergy of Europe who lived under his obedience, praying them to use their utmost efforts to discover the famous treatise of Arnold on the practice of medicine. The author had promised during his lifetime to make a present of the work to the Holy See, but died without fulfilling it. In a very curious work by Monsieur Longueville Arcouet, entitled The History of the Persons Who Have Lived Several Centuries and Then Grown Young Again, there is a receipt said to have been given by Arnold de Villeneuve by means of which anyone might prolong his life for a few hundred years or so. In the first place, say Arnold and Monsieur Arcouet, the person intending so to prolong his life must rub himself well 2 or 3 times a week with the juice or marrow of cassia, moelle de la casse. Every night upon going to bed he must put upon his heart a plaster composed of a certain quantity of oriental saffron, red rose leaves, sandalwood, aloes, and amber, liquefied in oil of roses and the best white wax. In the morning he must take it off and enclose it carefully in a leaden box till the next night, when it must be again applied. If he be of a sanguine temperament, he shall take 16 chickens, if phlegmatic, 25, and if melancholy, 30, which he shall put into a yard where the air and the water are pure. Upon these he is to feed, eating one a day. But previously the chickens are to be fattened by a peculiar method which will impregnate their flesh with the qualities that are to produce longevity in the eater. Being deprived of all other nourishment till they are almost dying of hunger, they are to be fed upon broth made of serpents and vinegar, which broth is to be thickened with wheat and bran. Various ceremonies are to be performed in the cooking of this mess, which those may see in the book of Monsieur Arcouet who are at all interested in the matter, and the chickens are to be fed upon it for 2 months. They are then fit for table and are to be washed down with moderate quantities of good white wine or claret. This regimen is to be followed regularly every 7 years, and anyone may live to be as old as Methuselah. It is right to state that Monsieur Arcouet has but little authority for attributing this precious composition to Arnold de Villeneuve. It is not found in the collected works of that philosopher, but was first brought to light by a Monsieur Poirier at the commencement of the 16th century, who asserted that he had discovered it in a manuscript in the undoubted writing of Arnold. Pietro d'Apone. This unlucky sage was born at Apone, near Padua, in the year 1250. Like his friend Arnold de Villeneuve, he was an eminent physician and a pretender to the arts of astrology and alchemy. He practiced for many years in Paris and made great wealth by killing and curing and telling fortunes. In an evil day for him, he returned to his own country with the reputation of being a magician of the first order. It was universally believed that he had drawn 7 evil spirits from the infernal regions, whom he kept enclosed in 7 crystal vases until he required their services, when he sent them forth to the ends of the earth to execute his pleasure. One spirit excelled in philosophy, a second in alchemy, a third in astrology, a fourth in physic, a fifth in poetry, a sixth in music, and the seventh in painting. And whenever Pietro wished for information or instruction in any of these arts, he had only to go to his crystal vase and liberate the presiding spirit. Immediately all the secrets of the art were revealed to him, and he might, if it pleased him, excel Homer in poetry, Apelles in painting, or Pythagoras himself in philosophy. Although he could make gold out of brass, it was said of him that he was very sparing of his powers in that respect, and kept himself constantly supplied with money by other and less creditable means. Whenever he dispersed gold, he muttered a certain charm, known only to himself, and next morning the gold was safe again in his own possession. The trader to whom he gave it might lock it in his strong box and have it guarded by a troop of soldiers, but the charmed metal flew back to its old master. Even if it were buried in the earth or thrown into the sea, the dawn of the next morning would behold it in the pockets of Pietro. Few people, in consequence, liked to have dealings with such a personage, especially for gold. Some, bolder than the rest, thought that his power did not extend over silver, but when they made the experiment, they found themselves mistaken. Bolts and bars could not restrain it, and it sometimes became invisible in their very hands, and was whisked through the air to the purse of the magician. He necessarily acquired a very bad character, and having given utterance to some sentiments regarding religion which were the very reverse of orthodox, he was summoned before the tribunals of the Inquisition to answer for his crimes as a heretic and a sorcerer. He loudly protested his innocence, even upon the rack, where he suffered more torture than nature could support. He died in prison ere his trial was concluded, but was afterwards found guilty. His bones were ordered to be dug up and publicly burned. He was also burned in effigy in the streets of Padua. Raymond Lully. While Arnold Villeneuve and Pietro Dapone flourished in France and Italy, a more celebrated adept than either appeared in Spain. This was Raymond Lully, a name which stands in the first rank among the alchemists. Unlike many of his predecessors, he made no pretensions to astrology or necromancy, but, taking Geber for his model, studied intently the nature and composition of metals, without reference to charms, incantations, or any foolish ceremonies. It was not, however, till late in life that he commenced his study of the art. His early and middle age were spent in a different manner, and his whole history is romantic in the extreme. He was born of an illustrious family in Mallorca in the year 1235. When that island was taken from the Saracens by James I, King of Aragon, in 1230, the father of Raymond, who was originally of Catalonia, settled there and received a considerable appointment from the crown. Raymond married at an early age, and being fond of pleasure, he left the solitudes of his native isle and passed over with his bride into Spain. He was made Grand Seneschal at the court of King James and led a gay life for several years. Faithless to his wife, he was always in the pursuit of some new beauty, till his heart was fixed at last by the lovely but unkind Ambrosia de Castello. This lady, like her admirer, was married, but unlike him, was faithful to her vows, and treated all his solicitations with disdain. Raymond was so enamored that repulse only increased his flame. He lingered all night under her windows, wrote passionate verses in her praise, neglected his affairs, and made himself the butt of all the courtiers. One day, while watching under her lattice, he by chance caught sight of her bosom as her neckerchief was blown aside by the wind. The fit of inspiration came over him, and he sat down and composed some tender stanzas upon the subject, and sent them to the lady. The fair Ambrosia had never before condescended to answer his letters, but she replied to this. She told him that she could never listen to his suit, that it was unbecoming in a wise man to fix his thoughts, as he had done, on any other than his God, and entreated him to devote himself to a religious life and conquer the unworthy passion which he had suffered to consume him. She, however, offered, if he wished it, to show him the fair bosom which had so captivated him. Raymond was delighted. He thought the latter part of this epistle but ill corresponded with the former, and that Ambrosia, in spite of the good advice she gave him, had at last relented and would make him as happy as he desired. He followed her about from place to place, entreating her to fulfill her promise. But still Ambrosia was cold, and implored him with tears to importune her no longer, for that she never could be his, and never would if she were free tomorrow. "What means your letter, then?" said the despairing lover. "I will show you," replied Ambrosia, who immediately uncovered her bosom and exposed to the eyes of her horror-stricken admirer a large cancer which had extended to both breasts. She saw that he was shocked, and extending her hand to him, she prayed him once more to lead a religious life and set his heart upon the Creator and not upon the creature. He went home an altered man. He threw up on the morrow his valuable appointment at the court, separated from his wife, and took a farewell of his children, after dividing one half of his ample fortune among them. The other half he shared among the poor. He then threw himself at the foot of a crucifix, and devoted himself to the service of God, vowing as the most acceptable atonement for his errors that he would employ the remainder of his days in the task of converting the Mussulmans to the Christian religion. In his dreams he saw Jesus Christ, who said to him, "Raymond, Raymond, follow me." The vision was three times repeated, and Raymond was convinced that it was an intimation direct from heaven. Having put his affairs in order, he set out on a pilgrimage to the shrine of St. James of Compostela, and afterwards lived for 10 years in solitude amid the mountains of Aranda. Here he learned the Arabic, to qualify himself for his mission of converting the Mohammedans. He also studied various sciences, as taught in the works of the learned men of the East, and first made acquaintance with the writings of Geber, which were destined to exercise so much influence over his future life. At the end of this probation, and when he had entered his 40th year, he emerged from his solitude into more active life. With some remains of his fortune, which had accumulated during his retirement, he founded a college for the study of Arabic, which was approved of by the Pope, with many commendations upon his zeal and piety. At this time he narrowly escaped assassination from an Arabian youth whom he had taken into his service. Raymond had prayed to God, in some of his accesses of fanaticism, that he might suffer martyrdom in his holy cause. His servant had overheard him, and, being as great a fanatic as his master, he resolved to gratify his wish and punish him at the same time for the curses which he incessantly launched against Muhammad and all who believed in him, by stabbing him to the heart. He therefore aimed a blow at his master as he sat one day at table, but the instinct of self-preservation being stronger than the desire of martyrdom, Raymond grappled with his antagonist and overthrew him. He scorned to take his life himself, but handed him over to the authorities of the town, by whom he was afterwards found dead in his prison. After this adventure, Raymond traveled to Paris, where he resided for some time, and made the acquaintance of Arnold de Villeneuve. From him he probably received some encouragement to search for the Philosopher's Stone, as he began from that time forth to devote less of his attention to religious matters and more to the study of alchemy. Still, he never lost sight of the great object for which he lived, the conversion of the Mohammedans, and proceeded to Rome to communicate personally with Pope John the 21st on the best measures to be adopted for that end. The Pope gave him encouragement in words, but failed to associate any other persons with him in the enterprise, which he meditated. Raymond therefore set out for Tunis alone, and was kindly received by many Arabian philosophers who had heard of his fame as a professor of alchemy. If he had stuck to alchemy while in their country, it would have been well for him, but he began cursing Muhammad and got himself into trouble. While preaching the doctrines of Christianity in the great bazaar of Tunis, he was arrested and thrown into prison. He was shortly afterwards brought to trial and sentenced to death. Some of his philosophic friends interceded hard for him, and he was pardoned upon condition that he left Africa immediately and never again set foot in it. If he was found there again, no matter what his object might be, or whatever length of time might intervene, his original sentence would be carried into execution. Raymond was not at all solicitous of martyrdom when it came to the point, whatever he might have been when there was no danger, and he gladly accepted his life upon these conditions and left Tunis with the intention of proceeding to Rome. He afterwards changed his plan and established himself at Milan, where, for a length of time, he practiced alchemy and, some say, astrology with great success. Most writers who believed in the secrets of alchemy and who have noticed the life of Raymond Lully assert that while in Milan he received letters from Edward, King of England, inviting him to settle in his states. They add that Lully gladly accepted the invitation and had apartments assigned for his use in the Tower of London, where he refined much gold, superintended the coinage of rose nobles, and made gold out of iron, quicksilver, lead, and pewter to the amount of 6 millions. The writers in the Biographie Universelle, an excellent authority in general, deny that Raymond was ever in England, and say that in all these stories of his wondrous powers as an alchemist, he has been mistaken for another Raymond, a Jew of Tarragona. Naudet, in his Apologie, says simply that 6 millions were given by Raymond Lully to King Edward to make war against the Turks and other infidels. Not that he transmuted so much metal into gold, but, as he afterwards adds, that he advised Edward to lay a tax upon wool, which produced that amount. To show that Raymond went to England, his admirers quote a work attributed to him, De Transmutatione Anime Metallorum, in which he expressly says that he was in England at the intercession of the king. The Hermetic writers are not agreed whether it was Edward I or Edward II who invited him over, but by fixing the date of his journey in 1312, they make it appear that it was Edward II. Edmund Dickinson, in his work on the Quintessences of the Philosophers, says that Raymond worked in Westminster Abbey, where, a long time after his departure, there was found in the cell which he had occupied a great quantity of golden dust, of which the architects made a great profit. In the biographical sketch of John Cremer, abbot of Westminster, given by Longley, It is said that it was chiefly through his instrumentality that Raymond came to England. Creamer had been himself for 30 years occupied in the vain search for the Philosopher's Stone, when he accidentally met Raymond in Italy and endeavored to induce him to communicate his grand secret. Raymond told him that he must find it for himself, as all great alchemists had done before him. Creamer, on his return to England, spoke to King Edward in high terms of the wonderful attainments of the philosopher, and a letter of invitation was forthwith sent him. Robert Constantinus, in the Nomenclatur Scriptorum Medicorum, published in 1515, says that after a great deal of research he found that Raymond Lully resided for some time in London, and that he actually made gold by means of the Philosopher's Stone in the Tower, that he had seen the golden pieces of his coinage, which were still named in England the Nobles of Raymond, or Rose Nobles. Lully himself appears to have boasted that he made gold, for in his well-known Testamentum he states that he converted no less than 50,000 pounds weight of quicksilver, lead, and pewter into that metal. It seems highly probable that the English king, believing in the extraordinary powers of the alchemist, invited him to England to make test of them, and that he was employed in refining gold and in coining. Camden, who is not credulous in matters like these, affords his countenance to the story of his coinage of nobles, and there is nothing at all wonderful in the fact of a man famous for his knowledge of metals being employed in such a capacity. Raymond was at this time an old man, in his 77th year, and somewhat in his dotage. He was willing enough to have it believed that he had discovered the grand secret, and supported the rumor rather than contradicted it. He did not long remain in England, but returned to Rome to carry out the projects which were nearer to his heart than the profession of alchemy. He had proposed them to several successive popes with little or no success. The first was a plan for the introduction of the Oriental languages into all the monasteries of Europe, the second for the reduction into one of all the military orders, that being united they might move more efficaciously against the Saracens, and the third that the sovereign pontiff should forbid the works of Averroes to be read in the schools, as being more favorable to Mahometanism than to Christianity. The Pope did not receive the old man with much cordiality, and after remaining for about 2 years in Rome, he proceeded once more to Africa, alone and unprotected, to preach the gospel of Jesus. He landed at Bona in 1314, and so irritated the Mahometans by cursing their prophet that they stoned him and left him for dead on the seashore. He was found some hours afterwards by a party of Genoese merchants, who conveyed him on board their vessel and sailed towards Majorca. The unfortunate man still breathed, but could not articulate. He lingered in this state for some days and expired just as the vessel arrived within sight of his native shores. His body was conveyed with great pomp to the church of St. Eulalia at Palma, where a public funeral was instituted in his honor. Miracles were afterwards said to have been worked at his tomb. Thus ended the career of Raymond Lully, one of the most extraordinary men of his age, and with the exception of his last boast about the 6 millions of gold, the least inclined to quackery of any of the professors of alchemy. His writings were very numerous and include nearly 500 volumes upon grammar, rhetoric, morals, theology, politics, civil and canon law, physics, metaphysics, astronomy, medicine, and chemistry. Roger Bacon. The powerful delusion of alchemy seized upon a mind still greater than that of Raymond Lully. Roger Bacon firmly believed in the Philosopher's Stone and spent much of his time in search of it. His example helped to render all the learned men of the time more convinced of its practicability and more eager in the pursuit. He was born at Ilchester in the county of Somerset in the year 1214. He studied for some time in the University of Oxford, and afterwards in that of Paris, in which he received the degree of Doctor of Divinity. Returning to England in 1240, he became a monk of the Order of St. Francis. He was by far the most learned man of his age, and his acquirements were so much above the comprehension of his contemporaries that they could only account for them by supposing that he was indebted for them to the devil. Voltaire has not inaptly designated him de l'or encrouté de toutes les ordures de son siècle. But the crust of superstition that enveloped his powerful mind, though it may have dimmed, could not obscure the brightness of his genius. To him, and apparently to him only, among all the inquiring spirits of the time, were known the properties of the concave and convex lens. He also invented the magic lantern, that pretty plaything of modern days, which acquired for him a reputation that embittered his life. In a history of alchemy, the name of this great man cannot be omitted, although unlike many others of whom we shall have occasion to speak, he only made it secondary to other pursuits. The love of universal knowledge that filled his mind would not allow him to neglect one branch of science, of which neither he nor the world could yet see the absurdity. He made ample amends for his time lost in this pursuit by his knowledge in physics and his acquaintance with astronomy. The telescope, burning glasses, and gunpowder are discoveries which may well carry his fame to the remotest time and make the world blind to the one spot of folly. The diagnosis of the age in which he lived, and the circumstances by which he was surrounded. His treatise on the admirable power of art and nature in the production of the Philosopher's Stone was translated into French by Girard de Tormes and published at Lyon in 1557. His Mirror of Alchemy was also published in French in the same year, and in Paris in 1612, with some additions from the works of Raymond Lully. A complete list of all the published treatises upon the subject may be seen in L'Anglais du Frenois. Pope John XXII. This prelate is said to have been the friend and pupil of Arnold de Villeneuve, by whom he was instructed in all the secrets of alchemy. Tradition asserts of him that he made great quantities of gold and died as rich as Croesus. He was born at Cahors, in the province of Guienne, in the year 1244. He was a very eloquent preacher and soon reached high dignity in the church. He wrote a work on the transmutation of metals and had a famous laboratory at Avignon. He issued two bulls against the numerous pretenders to the art who had sprung up in every part of Christendom, from which it might be inferred that he was himself free from the delusion. The alchemists claim him, however, as one of the most distinguished and successful professors of their art, and say that his bulls were not directed against the real adepts, but the false pretenders. They lay particular stress upon these words in his bull: Spondent, quas non exhibent, divitias pauperis alchemistae. These, it is clear, they say, relate only to poor alchemists, and therefore false ones. He died in the year 1344, leaving in his coffers a sum of 18 millions of florins. Popular belief alleged that he had made, and not amassed, this treasure, and alchemists complacently cite this as a proof that the philosopher's stone was not such a chimera as the incredulous pretended. They take it for granted that John really left this money, and ask by what possible means he could have accumulated it. Replying to their own question, they say triumphantly, his book shows it was by alchemy, the secrets of which he learned from Arnold de Villeneuve and Raymond Lully. But he was as prudent as all other hermetic philosophers. Whoever would read his book to find out his secret would employ all his labor in vain. The Pope took good care not to divulge it. Unluckily for their own credit, all these gold makers are in the same predicament. Their great secret loses its worth most wonderfully in the telling, and therefore they keep it snugly to themselves. Perhaps they thought that if everybody could transmute metals, gold would be so plentiful that it would be no longer valuable, and that some new art would be requisite to transmute it back again into steel and iron. If so, society is much indebted to them for their forbearance. Jean de Meung. All classes of men dabbled in the art at this time. The last mentioned was a pope. The one of whom we now speak was a poet. Jean de Meung, the celebrated author of the Roman de la Rose, was born in the year 1279 or 1280, and was a great personage at the courts of Louis X, Philip the Long, Charles IV, and Philip de Valois. His famous poem of the Roman de la Rose, which treats of every subject in vogue at that day, necessarily makes great mention of alchemy. Jean was a firm believer in the art, and wrote, besides his roman, two shorter poems, the one entitled The Remonstrance of Nature to the Wandering Alchemist, and The Reply of the Alchemist to Nature. Poetry and alchemy were his delight, and priests and women were his abomination. A pleasant story is related of him and the ladies of the court of Charles IV. He had written the following libelous couplet upon the fair sex. Tout être serait ou fout, de fait ou de volonté, putain, et qui très bien vous chercherait,